one speaker here. Wendy Gump, so if you would like to come forward then.
I brought, I'm just going to put them up here, and then if you guys want to tear them down, you can, but maybe it'll help during the, then my 3 minutes.
What is it, Wendy? What are they?
So, their budgets.
Okay.
So, as you know, I'm very big on the transparency stuff, and the budget stuff's pretty confusing to most of us. And in the spirit of the governor's encouragement to be more transparent so laypersons can understand it better in the schools, I've been looking at all of the site budgets for a long time. You know, athletics is really important to me, so I'm always trying to understand what it costs for sports at Torrey Pines. And so what I did was yesterday I was able to meet, or not yesterday, the day before, the foundation let me come and present to them at Torrey Pines. So this is what I presented to them. So ideas for building transparent school budgets. So each site's different, and we know that, right? So we trust our department heads to build a budget. The student needs, then the site sends it to the district. The district compiles a roll-up. District short of funds to run the district. District holds community outreach, shows shortage, above the line, below the line, focus to serve all students equally, then foundations answer the call. Because the foundations are there at the courtesy of the board to help fill gaps, right? So then I went here, 2017-18 revenue projections, and these are just from the numbers that came out, is the $134 million. These are the site budget needs at the adopted budget, $78 million for the sites. And I broke them down by middle schools, and then high schools, and then I put that athletic subcategory in here based on that, and I gave the information to Ms. Hebler because I did it all in a pivot table so you could sort things a lot easier. So then the question is, are the site budgets adequate? The site budgets include all the teachers, the certified employees, benefits, transportation, special ed, like everything that you would need to run a site. So if yes, what we have remaining is $65.1 million remains so we don't have deficit spending. So those are the must-haves. Then you have the below the not line, the needs and the wants. So this goes over here. Here's the adopted expenses, $143 million. That gives us the $9 million deficit. So the question is how do we help in the community where the needs and the wants can fill this gap so that we're not deficit spending? And so I just tried to do it in a really simple format. Because then the question is how does the community help? Well, the foundations were set up as a courtesy by the district to help fill these gaps, right? So the community wants to support. The question is how do we do that? Do we make direct monetary contributions directly to the district, or do we do it through the foundation? There's parent-centric fundraisers, so golf tournaments, galas, parties, all the things that the parents run to raise money. Then you have children-centric fundraisers. I think we need to understand what these are a little better. Then we have club sports. So these in red are things that I'm still trying to understand. Then you have over here what's called the free school guarantee. All of these things belong in here. And so I just wanted to, you know, kind of show you how that looks as you go through all of the budget today, because I think a lot of this plays into the budget. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So our primary program for the day is Ms. Douglas bringing us forward some information that has some of which we've already seen. So I'll let her take it away.
Good evening. So this evening we're just going to kind of go over big picture items and soliciting some feedback as we start to develop our budget here in the district for the 18-19 school year. So I'll give you a little bit of background in the sense of the governor's budget proposal, what may come, how some of that may translate to the district itself, and the things that we do as we're developing locally for our district budget here for 18-19. So the major proposals of the governor's budget is fully funding the local control funding formula, which 2 years early. So ultimately, what that means is he's advancing what we were going to get over the next 3 years, 2 years sooner. The same amount of money in that 3-year projection, we're still going to get that same amount of money. We're just advancing it. So we'll have less money coming in the two out years because he's given it to us sooner rather than later. So what that means, in essence, is that we still have, and we're looking at a three-year picture, we still have some gaps, as Ms. Gum pointed out, in terms of deficit, and we still need to be identifying some efficiencies within the budget on how we can kind of stabilize that, knowing that in future years what we will be receiving is the cost of living adjustments on that funding, and much of which will not even be able to pay for increased costs that we have on the natural, STRS and PERS and things of that nature. We have not been given any relief from the state for those extra costs that have now been transferred over to the district. He is providing one-time discretionary funding, which we have seen some of that in the past, so we will have that. There are some other pieces as well in the sense of teacher workforce for special ed, some CTE funding, special ed in the sense of aligning their local plan to the LCAP, and some one-time grants, if you will, to kind of help with the shortages in special ed teachers. So there's a lot of stuff that was proposed in the governor's budget that we still have to wait on trailer bills. So we'll be watching what that language turns out to be so that we can then take that and incorporate some of that into the budget where it applies. So we've seen a little bit of trailer bills coming through in terms of the transparency piece for LCAP. And ultimately, they're looking at providing a summary page, if you will, so that we can summarize our 100-plus page document into maybe one page. Why they didn't do that instead of adding all those pages, I don't know. But that language is still coming out, so we still have to keep our eye on that until it gets localized, and then we can translate that for us directly.
Okay, I see it. Answer my email. You probably didn't have time. So the funding, we're in LCFF, is that why aren't we in basic aid, and what is it per child if you're in basic aid, and what is it for LCFF?
We're going to get a little bit into that, but we're ultimately right now with the way basic aid works is basic aid is we get our property taxes, and our property taxes are higher than what the state would be giving us in local control funding formula. We're not there yet. And we talk a little bit about where that may come in later in the presentation. Ms. Pearly will go over that. But in terms of dollars per student, until we get there, because our enrollment will change at that level, it's kind of hard to determine what that will look like at that point in time. It depends on what our student population is in that year.
I think this year we were at about $8,900?
Yes.
Like, yeah. I'm doing my next question.
So this year we were at about $8,900 in local control funding formula per student. That's 7 through 12.
Okay. What about basic aid?
Well, if we're about 97% property tax. So 97% of that, so let's call it $8,800 or so, $8,700 or so would be our property tax revenue, and then the state's making up that extra $100 to $200, just doing the math off the top of my head. So does that make sense?
It does make sense, but could we flip? You said we could flip back.
Yeah, that's
how long would that take?
Well, you know, it's a year by year.
Right.
Yeah, it's a year to year calculation. So. Next year, we're getting a lot more in LCFF than we thought we were at the beginning of this year.
Okay.
And so right now, next year looks like it'll probably outpace the growth in our assessed value. Mm-hmm. So we're still chasing it. Here's property tax. Here's LCFF. We're kind of inching up at about the same clip right now.
Mm-hmm.
But once they slow down to COLA, I would anticipate that our property tax would jump up over LCFF. Where I think that slide is probably like in 3 years.
In 3 years. Yeah. That's kind of where we're projecting right now.
It could happen this year. It could happen next year. It really has to do with the turnover in properties within our district and how many students we have and what the state's willing to allocate towards local control funding formula. So it's those three things come into play, and it's a year-to-year-to-year calculation.
I guess most people ask me why we are in LCFF when most people are in basic aid in this area.
Well, it's you get whichever one gets you more. And right now, for high school districts, under the LCFF calculation, we have a higher allocation than what we receive in property tax.
Hmm.
So it's it's really that easy to yeah. explain.
It's not optional.
During the recession, right. yeah, a lot of people say, why don't you choose to right. do it? You get right. one or the other, and it's right. whichever one gives you more. Yeah. But the during the recession, really the only reason why we were basic aid is because the state cut its funding so much, mm-hmm. it dropped below the amount of property tax that we received. So we were basic aid during the recession and the recovery, and then when funding was restored, it jumped up back mm-hmm. above our property tax levels again, and we became... Prior to the recession, we were revenue limit. Then they changed it to LCFF during the recession, so now we're LCFF.
Okay. Yeah.
So, oops, I'm sorry.
Mark's still
there. That's very sensitive. Okay, so so we'll be keeping an eye on trailer bills to see how that impacts the district budget as we are preparing for all of that. Prop 98, we talked a little bit about, so this, the governor basically allocates our Prop 98 dollars, and he in turn tells us in what pots they come in. And so you can see here, a certain amount is for LCFF, a certain amount is for special ed, a certain amount is for community, adult ed, child nutrition, things of that nature, and then we have to basically identify what we're doing in our district, and it fits within this, or we're deficit spending. We don't have an option of trying to increase revenues. We have very limited opportunities to do that. We are implementing Saturday school, so that does help kind of generate some revenue. But in a district where our attendance rates are pretty high, it's not much in terms of getting some revenue back to recover for those absences. So we have to get what the governor provides to us, and then we have to allocate those resources based on our local priorities here within the district. I'm going to bring Ms. Curley up.
So, my job is to take the information from the state and put it into what it means for our district. And we're going to go over tonight some of the impacts it will have for the multi-year you'll see at second interim in March. We don't have that completed. We're going to remind you of the first interim multi-year. So with the funding, with the fully funded LCFF, that funding, as Tina mentioned, comes earlier rather than later. We had a certain amount of additional funds to help meet the implementation target in all of our out years. That all moves to the 18-19 year, which... What it does for 18-19 is actually pushes the basic aid just a little further out, but then your next years are simply COLA, and our current property tax projections are higher than our COLA projections.
State percentage COLA. Increase.
Right. Yeah. The COLA runs at about 2% estimated out. Our property tax, we estimate about 5, and we've been hitting at that the last few years. And so those future increases kind of have a slow down effect on the out year funding, but it pushes it into the current year. So we've kind of talked about that. Does not provide any additional funding over the multi-year projection, just moves it around a little bit. So it has an effect overall of not that much, has an effect on our 18-19 budget. I'll let you do that.
Okay.
So the increased LCFF funding raises that possibility of LCFF and basic aid, but in prior years, first of all, go back to 8-9, the year we went into basic aid, we did not know that until the very end of the year, and then we had an influx of property tax when the treasurer writes up what every agency gets in property tax. We had a large influx at the very end of the year that often will come actually on June 30th. And that then pushed the property tax higher than what was then revenue limit. So we didn't know until the very end of the year. That could happen the year we switch back in, and probably will, because we will be very close until the final calculation of property tax.
Yeah, sorry to jump in, but mm-hmm. you know, one of the things is that we get an estimate on property tax, and then the sorry about that. But we get the receipts on actual. So in a year when you have a lot of turnover on property and homes are reassessing and people are paying their temporary tax bills, that creates, you know, unanticipated revenue, and so that could happen if we have another boom year in any of these years.
So, as always, our multi-year projection has very cautious projections in it, both for property tax. COLA doesn't change that much. That's a school services estimate, and it fluctuates very little. So our property tax being the most conservative of those components that decide LCFF or basic aid. So we look at that every time we run an LCFF calculator. It's part of the calculation to determine where we fall. And I will say with the full funding in 18-19, it brings it 1 year closer. You know, as you know, we're always looking at 1 year beyond what we have in our required multi-year. And we've got our eye on that. And it's always been in that year or just beyond that that we could see it. Now it moves into our multi-year, but very close, within hundreds of thousands of dollars, not millions. So again, any change in how that plays out, any change in our assessed value, any change in our enrollment projections. If we had a lot more students, that would drive up LCFF, whereas property tax is going to stay what it stays for our assessed value. So hopefully that kind of brings it to light a little bit more.
I guess I wasn't clear. What I meant to articulate, how hard would it be to flip back? How much notice would we need? I guess that's what I was getting at. If we were to flip back to basic aid, like what you said, Eric, is there a time period that we could do it and then we miss it for the whole year?
No.
Or we could do it at any time. I guess that's what
I was
getting
at. It's really, as Ms. Perley mentions, you don't know your basic aid until the very end of the
right.
year, until June 30th. And the state doesn't even really recognize you for one more year after that. But either way, you get whichever one gives you more revenue. So
you could easily do that.
You could, okay. Yeah, so it's an easy transition.
But we would have likely adopted.
Yeah, the only reason why it was a difficult transition the last time it happened is it came on the heels of cuts. And mm-hmm. so, you know, our revenue was cut, but luckily we had a safety net of mm-hmm. a pretty high property tax revenue.
Okay.
So we didn't fall as far as we could have.
Okay,
so
that
answers my question. Thanks.
Yeah.
And with the basic aid, I know there was a fair share component contribution mm-hmm. we had to give back. Is that still part
that's,
of the formula?
This is Dolores' favorite topic.
It's my soapbox I was on last weekend. The fair share formula for basic aid districts, unfortunately, for those that were basic aid at the time of the implementation of LCFF, it was built into our calculator and remains there. And it literally, the calculator is pages, and it actually shows on there what we used to receive, the $8 million we used to receive in categorical, restricted mm-hmm. categorical funding, and the $343,000 that is our guarantee now.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all part of the guarantee built in that we will get at least the categorical funding. When the promise made in 13-14 was that we would at least get the categorical funding that we received in 12-13. Well, 12-13, we were basic aid and we had a fair share. So had we received full funding there, that $8 million, mm-hmm. that would be all part of our LCFF calculation. So it is still there. Nobody talks about it anymore. And oftentimes you hear... I heard a CBO from Northern California actually say, you still get those dollars. He was talking about deferred maintenance specifically. And I was sitting there going, no, we really don't, because I don't know which part of the $500,000 or so we used to receive in deferred maintenance, which part of the $343,000 we now receive is the proportionate share. I could run it and find out. But we receive dollars for deferred maintenance and some of our other programs. So it is kind of...
Yeah, there was a bill a couple years ago to try and recognize districts like us, because like Irvine yeah. Unified mm-hmm. was another one that was basic aid at that time and then became LCFF again.
Mm-hmm.
And they tried to recognize that we had all given up the categoricals, mm-hmm. and so... in a fair way, we should be guaranteed that and restored that in LCFF, but the bill failed. And so there were only a handful of districts like us who flipped back and forth, and it just went nowhere.
It would be another case of us being grandfathered into some weird formula that we lose again, funding was set up a long time ago. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, that if we would have switched into revenue limit in 12-13, actually, mm-hmm. fair share was delayed a year, but we mm-hmm. chances are we could receive more because of that categorical mm-hmm. funding that would have been somewhat restored the year if we went back into revenue limit. So again, one of the things I do in the summer when we're closing out the books is a final calculation of LCFF. So in answer to your question, that's when the final determination is made for the 17-18 year will be this summer, when we take all of our final attendance reports, we take our final property tax receipts, and do one final calculation that we reflect in our books. And that, I don't believe it will, but that could end up basic aid. I do believe the year we switch, it will be that close. Mm-hmm. It will be something that we don't determine till late in the year. We'll be before you with every budget saying, we think we might be there this year, much like 08-09, when that was kind of the communication all year long. So that's kind of how I see it as I look out into the future and what this full funding does to those calculations because of the growth, property tax growth being larger than. But our enrollment it plays a key piece to that we can't always anticipate. We can make estimates. So this is just the same multi-year you looked at in December, that's first interim. And just to kind of remind us all where we are, and it will look very different at second interim because we will have the 18-19 funding, and it will shift some of that 19-20 and 2021 revenue into 18-19. We'll help the deficit a bit there, but still overall, it's going to have about the same effects, and that depends too on our current year budget. So we'll have different figures in there at second interim, but I would anticipate that we'd see a little more movement in 18-19 than the out years. So. So the other couple other components of the budget were some ongoing funding for career technical education, and those that funding is still a little trailer bills are trickling out, and we don't quite know how that's going to look. It could look much like our CTE incentive grant that we've had the last 3 years and just continue that. It could look a little different. They have thrown in a community college piece that wasn't fully built in the same way to the incentive grant. So we're watching that because, as you know, we have many of those programs in our district. So we would welcome ongoing funding. It is something that has been lobbied quite a bit at the state going back to 12-13 or 13-14 when the funding began to be reduced from county offices that was passed through the district.
The good news on CTE is that there's widespread support for it up in Sacramento, and so there's already a bill that's been introduced in the legislature that looks a lot like the one-time incentive grant that we have now, the three-year grant that we're in our final year of. So it would work similar to that, but the governor is proposing less dollars but ongoing. And it's in collaboration with the community college district. So a little different take between governor and legislature. So this is what we do over the spring to see which proposal will shake out or if there's a compromise between the two.
Is that being weighted, though, more to community colleges? Because I know that we got cut a lot when that change happened before.
It's actually I believe the way the governor's proposal works is that it's actually a K-12 program, but it's in partnership with the community college district, and they have their own workforce development program, and it becomes an adjunct to that program, but it drops down into the high school level. So the intent of it is for additional funds to the community college program to be used for K-12. So that's, okay, if we understand the one paragraph that was released, that's how it would work.
But does that start happening like our Nixie stuff where it goes through them and then they decide whether they are really going to let us?
I hope not.
That was exactly what I was
going to
say.
Yeah.
Wow, I hope not. So then one other final piece that we've seen in the last several budgets is some one-time funding. It kind of writes up the current year funding by giving a little bit more funding, you know, the Prop 98 guarantee, which Tina will talk about a little bit, but it writes up the current year guarantee by giving us funding next year in a one-time fashion. This often will take on a couple of different forms between proposed budget, may revise, and final budget. Sometimes it just grows a little bit. Sometimes it adjusts down ever so slightly. And last year, it had some weird curve in it by may revise that we didn't include it in our budget because it was saying it's next year's budget, but you won't get it till the year after that, and we can't recognize that. It was too iffy. No one recommended that we recognize that. So we don't always include the one-time funding in our budget. We bring it second interim in that multi-year projection because of those reasons, that it can change. It can change a lot. We don't want to make budget decisions based on that. But we do anticipate that we would have that one-time funding again. Once again, the governor has suggested, you know, four different uses for it, and it pays down our mandates. So also a bit of a soapbox topic of mine and many others, because we're supposed to do several things with it, and it satisfies the debt that no one ever thought would be satisfied that way. So with that, I'm going to pass it back.
Sorry, we keep going back and forth. Hopefully that doesn't throw anybody off. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot that goes into developing the budget, and so that's ultimately why we're here tonight, to kind of talk through some of what that looks like. And as we are getting additional dollars for LCFF, we also have some increase in costs that continue to rise even beyond our three-year multi-year projection. And this is just kind of a snapshot of the annual increases for what we have in terms of STRS and PERS, and what those cumulative costs are. So you can see that with the money that we're getting from the state, just these costs alone, we really have to take that kind of off the top, because we have no choice as to whether or not we pay this. It's not like a choice that we may make for something different, of shifting some money around for Title I, and, you know, this is something that we have to pay for. It's not something that we can take out of our budget and say we don't want to do. So that's just kind of a big picture scope. We've talked a little bit about budget, and the LCAP is a big piece of that. Here in this district, our unduplicated pupil count is not as large, so we don't get a big chunk of supplemental dollars. But we do have a requirement to make sure that we're improving and increasing services to students and closing the achievement gap for those. And so there's a component that we have to make sure we're watching the dashboard, if you will, and identifying those populations and looking at what we get in terms of LCFF dollars and using that to help provide extra supports for those kids. So that is something that we do have to make sure that we're doing. Not a lot of flexibility in those dollars. And some will make an argument that to some degree it feels kind of categorical, but making sure that we're identifying for that particular population what we can do to make things better and kind of close that achievement gap. So that is something that we do have to take a look at. We'll be working with Manuel on identifying what that looks like. And, you know, again, very beginning conversations of what we need to do, and LCAP conversations and input and things of that nature. PERS and STRS. So you hear this a lot, I'm sure, and you probably have heard it at CSBA. There's a lot of advocacy surrounding the increased cost of pension at the state level, and just really advocating for additional dollars to help provide relief, if you will, because ultimately these increased costs are eroding what we're getting in our local control funding formula. You know, yes, they're providing it for our students, but at the same time, these increased costs are eating away at that. So in a time where we would not have had this, we would have had all of those dollars to use for our students. And because of these increased costs, of which we have zero control over, we have to make sure that we're including, you know, this in our budget. So we've got that, and they will continue on through 22-23, I believe. And our PERS rates are increasing as well. And if you look at the two combined, it's close to almost $2 million in increased costs for the upcoming school year. So we have to continue to kind of monitor that. So right off the top, trying to stabilize some of those expenses just to help with the cost of the increased cost of these plans. Special ed.
Ms. Herman has
a question. Yes.
Are we with the advocacy? Are we seeing any movement? Or is that just they're just saying, yes, we know you have that problem, but we can't help you? Is that?
It's mainly what I've been hearing is that everyone recognizes that it's an increased cost. But unfortunately, I was in Sacramento 2 weeks ago, we don't see much interest in making the Prop 98 pie bigger. They really do see the minimum guarantee as the ceiling and not the floor that it was meant to be when it was passed by the voters. And so I met with the finance department director who oversees Prop 98, and he basically says, when I come to the table with all of the other program directors, they say, we have to give education this much, and the rest is available for all of the other state services. And so, and the legislature essentially follows suit and says, here's the Prop 98 guarantee, we'll fund that much. And I really, one of the jargon terms I really dislike that they use up there is whenever they accidentally give us more than the Prop 98 guarantee, they say that, and it's always accidental, they say Prop 98 is over-appropriated.
If they're talking with other public agencies, you know, about what they're giving us, are those agencies not having public employees who have been affected by this PEPRA, their costs are going up? I mean, shouldn't we all be at that?
They all
stay. Governor's
they
tables
all, yeah, the
screaming?
Rest of the state budget shares in the PERS issue. Only education shares
the
STRS. In the STRS issue, but it's. They're affected.
It just
as
seems
well.
Like everybody should be at that conversation, upset about it, not just education.
There's also been, and Eric can probably speak more to that as well, but there's also conversations around advocating for additional base dollars because the premise is we're not getting enough in base to even cover our regular ongoing operating expenses. And yes, although we understand, and then there's a need to provide supplemental and concentration dollars to help support those kids, we're underfunded at the base level, and there are many districts that potentially are using supplemental and concentration dollars to pay for the increased costs of STRS and PERS because they don't have enough in their base to cover. And that's just the reality. And so we're hoping that there'll be some more advocacy efforts around that, but again, they're working with a finite amount of money as well.
Yeah, and the LCFF is just a distribution model. And so when the formula was created, the base and the supplemental and the concentration weren't based on any amount that they thought was adequate. It was, here's how many dollars we have, and here's how we're going to spread it. And it was just redistribution of the old revenue limit formula in a different way. And so it was never had any basis in reality of what it takes to actually run an effective educational program.
So some of the other things that we're looking at, there was a COLA provided, a cost of living increase provided to special ed, and so small, but keeping in mind that we do have a SELPA, and so anything that they do at the SELPA level, and this was a conversation that took place actually at one of the SELPA finance director meetings, when they have people that are charged basically to the SELPA dollars, they take money kind of off of the top to help provide services to school districts. And when they give an increase in pay, that comes off of the funding that's been allocated to the districts within that SELPA. Mm-hmm. And so there's many conversations around how the SELPA uses their dollars with the districts that are in that SELPA. And so the SELPA is looking as well in terms of trying to decrease some of their program costs, because then obviously the less cost they have, the more the school districts get to support it. So we continue to kind of look at what's happening in special ed and making sure that we're providing, you know, opportunities for that subgroup. And just like any other place in the budget, if there are areas where we might be able to kind of streamline processes or things of that nature, we're looking without it being a impact to students.
Another unfortunate reality about our SELPA is that the SELPA's funding throughout the state is unequal. And so every SELPA has its own funding rate, and it goes back decades to when they set that in stone. And so we are one of those SELPAs that is below the average. And so even if we were funded at the average, it would be a benefit to the 14 districts in North County. But you know, so we're low funded when it comes to LCFF. We're low funded when it comes to special education funding. It's
I have a question, Eric. You know, when I was at the NICSE meeting, they were saying if we don't give them a raise, then we'll lose people, other districts.
They'd lose them to us.
You know, but they were saying actually not the special ed in the SELP, is that we would lose the people and they would go somewhere else just because of that very reason. They can make more money somewhere else.
Yeah, that, you know, it's county office employees, and so they have to look at not only the SELPA employees but their court school employees, mm-hmm. and so all right. of their certificates are kind of treated the same. There's a lot of competition out there for special right. education teachers with the severe shortage there is. I've always advocated for smaller SELPA programs and for more funding to go to the districts, but not all 14 districts see it that way in the SELPA. So we continue to have these off-the-top programs, and we have to carry the weight of it, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is there any more movement in adding the special ed as a subgroup to LCFF? I know there was talk, but I have no more.
Nothing's come out so far this year.
Okay.
Yeah. When it was first thrown out there, they said it'd be too hard, so they said we'll think about that down the road, and they mm-hmm. haven't brought it back.
And they, you know, they are one of the things that came out in terms of the governor's budget proposal is kind of aligning the SELPA with the local plans, which, as you can imagine, with 14 districts within that SELPA, how do you align a SELPA with 14 district LCAPs that could have very different demographics amongst all of them? I mean, okay. we've got Oceanside and right. Vista. So how that's going to transpire, we don't know, so we'll keep an eye on all of that and see how that might trickle down to us at the district level. And by the time May Revise comes around, all of this should kind of start to have a clearer picture so that we can develop a budget that's more succinct. But we just wanted to give you guys information on what is transpiring currently. This is Dolores. Let me come back up.
So as we head into budget preparation, 18-19 budget, early preparation building that budget, staffing assumptions in the multi-year are really kind of our baseline for building them into 18-19, because at the multi-year, we don't know who's going where. We build in some basic assumptions. Normal increases for step and column. We've got the STIRS and PERS in there, as well as an estimate on our increase in health and welfare. And we keep that in there until early in the next year when we see our new rates. So those are built into our multi-year at any given time. And as we transition from 18-19 being a multi-year column to actually building it per people, we start with what we have. We look at our known retirements, and we begin looking at cost savings of what replacements are needed in those areas. So it is a fairly simple process starting where we're at. It's not complex in any way, but all those increases are built in as part of that process. And they're always built in at any given time in the multi-year. So the reserve cap that has been discussed over the years is a topic that has moved ever so slightly. So this slide and the next one talks about the tests that need to be met in 17-18. All four of the dynamics have not been met. Therefore, in 18-19, we would not have that reserve cap. It's not as big of an issue as it once was because it has made some progressive movement from the original budget, the reserve caps. The interesting thing with the new legislation signed into law in October 2017 was that it would exempt basic aid districts. So that's kind of about the only movement that benefits districts, especially basic aid districts that have a little more or a little less control over their funding and a little more volatility possibly in their budget and if they have additional students. So once we reach that point, whenever that comes, then we're, if we don't reach enough students to go back into LCFF, we're funding the students we have with the same dollars that maybe we had, you know, in prior years, or the same dollar. If we don't grow because of that, if we were to get an influx of students next year, our multi-year would look different because we are under LCFF. We would have additional funding to match the students so that we could add the teachers. Under basic aid, you don't always have that if you don't push over the threshold. So just kind of some other history there. Ending balance history slide. You've seen this many times. We generally bring it each year. So it's kind of just updated for you to see there. The line that is ends in the 15-16 year is the average high school district in California and what their reserves are. So kind of gives you a picture of the gray bar that is solid in the back is CSBA's recommended reserve. That is at 17 and has remained there since the beginning of the talk of the reserve limit. So CSBA hasn't moved on that, and unfortunately not much legislation has moved either. So
So we're telling you, we're giving you a whole lot of information so you have an idea of what we deal with as we're going through budget development. As we look at staffing enrollments, we just got our first swipe at a projection for next year. So we had a conversation with principals this morning around staffing. We'll be looking at that, and HR will be working with principals on what that looks like at each of the site levels. We have staffing formulas, so pretty basic in the sense of how many teachers do we need at each school site. Those are easy conversations. Those we can kind of balance in the budget. Other things, and we've heard some of this before in the sense of bus passes. Other things obviously would be helpful in terms of getting some feedback on where we go and what we can do moving forward to kind of help with our deficit spending issue. So the next round of slides, if you will really all be around transportation. From the last couple of presentations that we've done, nothing is new in the sense of any data that we're presenting, but just a reiteration, because as I said at the last board meeting, when I talked about transportation, we're going to have some real issues around what we're going to be able to provide, especially with some retirements and things of that nature. We know potentially we could have five, and we're really struggling to get bus drivers. There may come a point where we won't have somebody to run a route. So I just wanted to go through the slides again, and I'll go through them quickly because you've heard it before. We've had a steady decrease over the last 10 years, 65.
We're way ahead of time, so take your time.
Oh, okay. No, well, there might be a lot of discussion.
No need to rush. Closed session doesn't start till 6.
Okay. So we've had a steady decrease in bus passes or in ridership, 65% over the last 10 years, significant in terms of ridership. A lot of different reasons for that, schedule changes, things of that nature. I've shared with you some of the routes. We'll come back to this slide, but later on maybe in the presentation. But ultimately, just wanted to make sure that the board was aware of some of the capacity that we're looking at. So we've got, you know, a route here in the morning with only 4% capacity. Literally, it could be eight students on a bus. And obviously, as you are aware, the cost. But even beyond that, like I said, I think the biggest challenge for us right now is being able to get bus drivers. So we've got another one here at Earl Warren with only 24% capacity. You can see in some areas there's obviously a higher need. So that's what we look like in terms of middle school, high school routes, the same. You can see the capacity here. These are what we call our shuttles in terms of ridership. And full capacity is 50 to a bus, so it gives you some context behind the numbers. So considerations for the upcoming year. We've talked about the aging bus fleet, and the board approved at the last board meeting some lease finance purchasing of buses. So we're actually going to be replacing some of our older fleet. So thank you for that. Dan Love is very happy. And so we were having a hard time just getting parts for buses. They stopped manufacturing them after 10 years. So having the new buses will be helpful in the sense of keeping those buses on the road longer, obviously. Our average mileage is 203,000. We've had over 61,000 increase over the last 2 years. Major downtime, I've talked about that, replacement parts. I mean, we spend hours upon hours of trying to find parts for our buses. So the funding that you approve is going to help us with some of that at least. Athletic transportation. So we have 1,500 athletic field trips a year, many student athletes, and a lot of the athletic transportation has to be chartered out because we don't have enough infrastructure here to be able to support all of the field trips and the athletic events. We had, just in the last 2 weeks, there were seven different trips where Mr. Love was trying to find bus routes. So what we couldn't, for I think it was LCC cheer, we didn't have a bus. The charters were out of buses, and so they ended up finding rides for all the students themselves like they would typically maybe on a Saturday. And so we're starting to run into that. We've got a lot of, we can't make our bus drivers pick up extra routes. And so there are many bus drivers that aren't available even currently with
what
we do have.
Well, it also conflicts with the afternoon middle school routes.
Correct, right. And we have an ongoing recruitment for bus drivers on a regular basis. And if a bus driver is out, we have some staff within the transportation department that still maintain their licenses that will go out and pick up a route when we need to. And I think that's the biggest challenge that we're running up against is we're worried that we're not going to be able to fill the potential five that we have coming that's with the resignations. We've had one position that's been posted now. Dan Love will go out and do his own recruitment. We still can't get anybody. We do our own internal training, and so even if you don't have any experience, we will bring you in and we will train you, and we will get you bus certification so that we can get them to so that we can get bus drivers, because right now we're having a really hard time with that. Last time I think I shared with you some of the school districts around our area that have eliminated the home-to-school transportation. Our feeder districts have all eliminated it. That you see up there, the districts without middle school and high school transportation. So what does that mean? So ultimately, what we're looking at is what's our cost of continuing to do business? And although, yes, money is a factor, it's not our biggest issue. It's not necessarily we need to eliminate this or we need to reduce this program in order to keep us fiscally solvent. That's not the issue. The issue is more of we're not going to be able to get the drivers in here to deal with some of our routes. And so what we would like to propose is eliminating middle school and high school transportation. At the end of the day, there wouldn't be any reduction in staff because with the 5 retirements, we don't think we're going to get anybody to fill those positions anyways. So ultimately, the staff that we would have left would just be able to be used for our athletics and field trips, and then we wouldn't have to contract out and charter out with other agencies to provide those services. At the very least, because obviously we know that, you know, this is not an easy conversation to have, we do have some low ridership routes, and maybe even looking at ways that we might be able to condense and collapse some of those routes so that we can make the routes within the bus drivers that we do have and that we may be able to get for when those positions do come up for retirement for the upcoming 18-19 school year. Obviously, if we were able to do that, we wouldn't have to contract out with charters, so that would save us. We wouldn't have families having to drive their own kids, et cetera, to field trips and things of that nature. So there'll be kind of a double savings, if you will, of not having to pay for charters. We have generous donations from foundations for transportation and other areas, but still, again, I go back to it's not even a funding problem. It's just a people problem, and so there would be no change to special education. It really would be around the home to school, middle and high school transportation, and wanted to just open up the conversation to get some feedback on potentially where we could go as we're looking at developing the budget for the 18-19 school year. We are sending out a transportation survey to all of the parents within the community, so we'll get some of that information back, and it's going out to everyone, not just the parents who have current transportation. So we'll use some of that feedback as well, and we'll provide the information to the board. But again, the beginning part of the conversation, because we still don't know what all the trailer bills are going to look like, et cetera, but so that we can have some conversations around what that will look like for 18-19 as we're developing that budget.
So as you see, it says consideration, not recommendation. So, you know, this is still in the consideration stage of this. I know it's not the first time that we've talked about it in this room, and there were times when it really was about how could we reuse revenue in different ways or reduce expenditures. But now we're having, as Ms. Douglas points out, a number of different factors now that are affecting our ability to deliver this service. So I think the survey will help us. You know, we did one probably about 3.5-4 years ago. Actually, I think this time 4 years ago, we did the same thing to ask parents, how important is it to you, and can you get your student to school in any other way? And so there's a number of different types of questions that are asked to test the attitudes and importance of transportation. And that was when, if you remember that slide a few slides ago, that was when we had a lot more people riding the bus, and now we have much fewer. So it'll be interesting to see what the parent attitude is on this.
So you're saying we just can't hire 5 drivers? That's it?
Yeah.
Well, it's
5. We can't even hire 1.
I think we have 3 vacancies.
How much do we pay them?
You know what? I don't know. I'd have to look at the salary schedule, but it's not pay. It's an industry issue. I mean, that's even charter buses
aren't
even
pay. You pay more and you'll get more drivers. It's got to be that.
Well,
I mean,
but I know.
If you're paying $20 an hour and you pay $100 an hour, I bet you'd get more.
Yeah.
Right? So if it's not a money issue and you want buses, pay more.
I know I think I mentioned this last time, people that need the special licenses to drive the different buses, even if they're not the hugest ones. And I know in, like, even the retirement communities, they're having the same issue, you know, and they're not tied by contract amounts, then they can offer more, but they can't get people to run their buses to maintain their services to doctors and...
I'm just saying buses are on the road. People, there must be bus drivers somewhere. Everything comes down to money.
It's so. I talked to Dan Love about it. It says 2 drivers that I had so they could get more money somewhere else, and that's why they didn't apply.
Well, I think it's that kind of what we've heard about scheduling. It's money, but it's a different type of money.
It's a different type of lifestyle,
Morning route, afternoon route. So the amount of money they can make overall is not that much. The charter part helps because when they can do the charter ones, then those are longer charters and they make more money. So the school bus routes themselves are the ones that are more difficult because you're talking of just, you know, a break in a shift, 2 hours in the morning, 2 hours in the afternoon.
No, I agree. It sounds awful, but yeah. I'm just saying if I'm just saying if it's not a money issue and you want to have them, I'm sure you could at some point find it. Well, you don't want to have buses because nobody's riding them. You know, that's a different issue.
Yeah, that's a different issue. So I have a question. What about La Colonia? I thought we had a bus running from there to Torrey Pines. What would happen with the kids there?
So that would be another, you know, consideration of, you know, do we continue that or not? You know, I've looked at our supplemental funds because that one is, you know, specifically targeted for a community that has difficulty with transportation.
Right.
And so, you know, that's where we have a higher concentration of our low-income and English learner students. That's what those funds are for. So Ms. Douglas and I have talked about, you know, when we look at everything else we want to do classroom-based, can we also work to cover some of that cost with our supplemental funds? Because that's actually what other districts are doing. We haven't looked at it that way to allocate funds to keep that shuttle. And those of you who missed out, Sandra's been on the board for a while and probably remembers that we used to have desegregation grant funds long ago, and that's how those shuttles were created. And then we had some targeted funds that then supported that those routes. And then those got rolled into, well, they got cut in our fair share.
And then
they got rolled into the LCFF. So theoretically they're there, but they're not specific to those types of activities anymore. So, you know, that was a long ago, the intent of creating those shuttles was with targeted funds to service communities like that. So we're looking at creatively, like if we, you know, maybe collapsed some of these routes where we could to be more efficient with middle school, use some of our targeted funds for the low-income communities so that we can maintain that, because that really is the only shuttle that we have for the high school. The Sunset one is because they're on their way back, and the bus yard is right by there, so it's an easy one. It's kind of a no-brainer. It'd be an empty bus if we didn't bring kids up to Sunset.
It's a small shuttle.
Yeah.
For La Colonia, that
actually, that's one
a
of the more
one,
yeah, and that's so and that's and that's about 25-30 kids run that, so we wouldn't be able to run a van or anything.
But
so,
it's the Sunset run, that's why the afternoon route's at 70% when the morning's 10% type of thing.
Do other school districts like Oceanside not even have any buses at all? They just
look at the list.
No, I know they don't. But how do they get their teams to sporting events? Do they just charter them out?
Or they use the buses that they do have, because Oceanside does still have a fleet of buses.
They have buses, but they only use them for
kids. Correct. Right.
Special.
Right. Athletic events, field trips, things
like
that.
How do they have those employees?
How
do they maintain employees if it's just to do that? Or is that not a problem because that's in the afternoon?
That I don't know. But my assumption would be similar to how we would be able to do it here. We wouldn't necessarily have a need for a split shift. You know, we wouldn't have the need with the conflicts in terms of the routes for afternoons and the afternoon events. So my assumption would be something similar to that.
What's interesting is every morning and every afternoon I drive by San Diego Unified's bus yard in Kearny Mesa, and in the morning.
Oh yeah, I see that.
Morning it's when those buses should be on the road because I'm on my way into work, and
the lot's full
with buses, so they've got all those buses parked. I always, every time I drive by, I wonder what are they doing with all those buses?
I always wonder how they even park them like that. Really packed, isn't it?
It's very rare that you see empty spaces in that bus yard when you drive by. Sometimes I see it at night on my way home.
So as we, with Pacific Trails opening and reducing some of our numbers on the Carmel Valley campus, I see we still have some pretty hefty routes going there. Did we lose any routes from there at the time? I mean, did we collapse anything down when we lost?
Yeah, we. This is before your time, so I'll answer. I think we dropped two routes at Carmel Valley when we created the Pacific Trails attendance area. I think it was
so. Some of the outliers in that direction.
My guess on that would be that's like Carmel Country Highlands across the 56.
Yeah, it was two routes. Actually, it was one Carmel Valley route, and then we had another one that was going from Carmel Valley to Earl Warren to try and pull kids up into Earl Warren. And we didn't need to do that one anymore because the enrollment balanced out between those three middle schools. So it was one Carmel Valley and one Earl Warren. were the net effect of opening Pacific Trails, which has no home-to-school transportation.
But here, this is current.
This is current, correct.
And it says still we have two routes to Carmel Valley that have 100% capacity and another one that has 90% capacity. So...
Yeah, that's we were talking about that earlier. That would be a consideration too. Is looking at
the impact in that neighborhood to bring those cars in,
and to ensure that it's not seen as, well, we're targeting cuts to the northern middle schools and preserving the south, and so it just so happens that we've got full buses running at almost full capacity in the south, but not in the north.
Well,
so.
but the Gainio, that's.
Right.
Well,
on one of them.
You know, I can understand that's a split area.
So I'd want to be sensitive if we were looking to consolidate, just so it's not seen as, you know, this is that we're targeting certain schools. It's, you know, it would really be on the capacity.
Yeah, well, I think the issue with Carmel Valley, too, is the...
It's the freeway.
It's the 52. But it's also the drop-off and access up to the school. All of a sudden, if those are all cars coming in, there would have to be some solution possibly for parents working out their own bus carpools or something, if we would take that away. Because, again, I live down the street, and I know what that looks like in the morning, I'd be concerned about...
I never schedule meetings at Carmel Valley in the morning. I'll sit in that traffic, too. So, it's... But those are mostly the Carmel Valley routes are mostly south of the 52. I think they're all south of
they
the
must
52.
They must be, because I think that's the only one. Yeah. Those are the only ones that qualify to be transported.
Yeah.
Well, do you need any other direction from us in looking at this?
We want to hear your thoughts, because we're going to take some more input. But
separate question. So you're talking about then how would the schedule look like if we let go of those five buses for the bus drivers? If we can't fill those spots, what is the new work schedule are going to look like for them?
Well, we haven't even gone down that path, if you will, of looking that far, because we weren't sure kind of where the board's thought process was on what we can do. At the end of the day, though, we know that at the very least we would be able to not backfill those positions and be able to redeploy, if you will, the positions that are left to support the other pieces of athletics and field trips and things of that nature. But in terms of schedules, we haven't gotten down to that level of detail.
My question would really be is, if you're talking about, okay, right now we're employing them all day, and now you're just saying I'm going to employ you in the afternoon, is that would those people leave? Would it be go from a full-time to a part-time position?
No, because we also have, you know, field trips and things of that nature that are done throughout the day, not just after school. So there will be some, and if you think about in terms of the amount. So if we're if there are five positions that are retiring that we wouldn't be backfilling, obviously we have a smaller pool of drivers, so that would just be dispersed out. All the work really would be dispersed out to those that are left within
the
program.
So it's really what the efficiency would be in all of if we were to make a movement here to reduce routes of for home to school would be not having to contract out as much. So that's and that does cost us more. So there'd be some cost savings to do that. So it would just be redeploying the remaining drivers and buses that we have to lessen the impact on our charter costs.
So what's the average age of the bus drivers?
Of the bus drivers?
Is because if we can't recruit new drivers, where are we at with that?
I don't know what the average age of the bus drivers are.
I haven't looked at it in a while.
Because if they're leaving and we can't hire any new ones, then we're going to be in trouble.
Yep.
We have an aging bus driver.
What's the population look like?
It's a number of them are over 55.
Yeah.
So that's where that could be another issue.
Is there in the survey to the parents any question that addresses things like if there were not a morning route, would you still sign up for the afternoon routes that are, you know?
And that's one of the things that we changed that we made a few years ago, just to try and get more students to ride the bus. Because if you recall, we used to have
let them do a one-way pass.
We had one fee, and it didn't matter. And we split it to say, if you're only going to ride in the morning, we'll take you in the morning. If you're only going to ride in the afternoon, and so we did cut the cost split the pass for those who only wanted to go one way. So we did offer some more flexibility a few years ago. So we've already kind of asked that question.
Done that in effect.
Could we do a survey on pay and find out how much everyone else is paying? I think that would should be our first thing that we need to do.
Sure.
And the other organizations.
Right. I'm looking currently on EdJoin, and Susan can certainly do a survey. More than likely, we're in the upper amount. When in my previous district, I was in charge of transportation, and we did raise the hourly rate, and it was not affected unless you went extremely high, I'm sure. Currently in the state of California, there's 627 openings for bus drivers.
Well, the thing is, I know that the Girls and Boys Club are paying more. All the other organizations are paying more. I think that don't mean survey schools. I mean survey other organizations.
So and market
schools,
survey.
EdJoin is, let's face it, then you're just in a little circle. Is we need to go out and beyond that and find out why we're not getting the drivers.
But I think one of the big points that one of the other governing board members made was that they have to work split shifts. In other agencies, mm-hmm. they may be able to employ them for a continuous 6 or 8 hours.
Right.
But we frequently don't have a need for the hours in between, so it is an economically wise decision to have someone sitting.
Right.
Or they might have as if it's Boys and Girls Club, they might only be working in the afternoon. They've got a job in the morning.
Right. The only incentive we have is because of the retirement and the benefits.
Yep.
Correct.
And that's costly, too. That's why it doesn't go into their pay, I'm
right.
sure.
Right. So any increase that we provide on the salary schedule translates to about an additional 30% just for the statutory benefits, including PERS.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure that's why they're getting a higher pay somewhere else when you're contracting out.
Their benefits might be lower. And
that's what's get an hourly wage.
Well, and you know, I've been torn on this before, but I was in Del Mar when they made the decision to get rid of the busing, and they were very concerned about that and thought there would be a lot of objection, and then there really wasn't, and I know each school district has had to go through that. So, you know, it is tough because it's been the tradition of the district, but we're really the only district left doing that besides mm-hmm. San Diego Unified. So, you know, if the parents were given enough information to figure out other ways of getting their students to school or if there are other options out there. But really, in the survey, to talk about, you know, giving them information, not just questions, but mm-hmm. saying this is mm-hmm. what it's costing, mm-hmm. this is what we're doing.
And a lot of our questions did do that a few years ago where we said, what it costs, and now how do you feel about it?
Yeah, because it's especially for families that live further away and send their kids, it's a real convenience, and I know the reason we've had it for so long, but it does get to be difficult not only as a budget priority, but also if we're having trouble financing it, finding the proper employees. So,
if you don't have it, will it affect the amount of attendance, do you think?
It conceivably could.
It could.
Which, mm-hmm. you know, then.
Yeah. Again, it's 360 some kids who would have to mm-hmm. find another way to get to school on time.
Yeah, I think ultimately they figured out. But.
Mm-hmm. And one of the questions that we we've asked in the survey previously and in the most current one is what other means of transportation do you have in getting your kids to school so that we can gauge if there is no other way for them to bring their kids to school, if the bus is the only way. So hopefully with the information that we're getting back, it will help. Again, you know, my worry is that we're going to get to a point in the next school year that there's going to be routes that we're not going to be able to provide service to because we don't have a driver. And especially in some of the areas where the ridership is extremely low, looking at maybe consolidating some of those routes, even if it's not a total elimination, just so that, you know, we can help mitigate some of the staffing that we may not have for next year.
And the biggest fear of all would be some morning we've got kids standing on a bus stop.
That's exactly right. That would be the worst thing.
If we've got no driver and we have no subs. That's usually when Mr. Love hops on the bus and runs or his dispatchers. They do. The office staff maintain their licenses for those critical situations. But it does happen from time to time.
Yeah, where kids are outside.
Yeah.
I see that outside of Decatur.
Well, you know, I mean, it may sound like harsh, but I mean, with the share economy now, there's many other options for transportation. You know, I think, I personally think it makes sense to maybe either cut a lot or completely the buses. I mean, I just think we're in the business of education, not necessarily transportation.
So how much would that put back in the budget if we were to do that?
If you run the numbers.
It could potentially, in terms of the cost right now, just with athletic transportation, without having to charter that out, it could be a potential savings of somewhere in the ballpark of about $400,000 if we're able to do it in-house as opposed to out. And then in the sense of the contribution to home to school, do you have the number off the top of your head? Because I have it on my sheet back at the office in the desk.
I don't. Not currently.
Yeah. I want to say it's somewhere in the ballpark of close to that, about $300,000 to $400,000. In the sense of home to school transportation, obviously special ed transportation.
In terms of what it impacts our general fund beyond what we collect for the pass.
Right.
So, you know, they back out, when they do the calculation, they back out the bus pass sales and, you know, other sources of revenue for that, and then they look at the expenditure side and get the net.
Especially with diesel going up too, gas.
And even one of the other ways, Ms. Hurley just showed me our current rate of pay. So mm-hmm. it's almost $20 to $26 on the high end of the salary schedule. So, and we've got drivers that have been here for quite some time, so probably most of them are on that higher pay range. That you guys had asked that question.
Yeah. So $26, what year? You're talking 20 to start, $26 being 12 years?
Seven. That'd be their seventh year.
Yeah. Okay. So 22, yeah.
But I know they're not full.
And Dolores just whispered in my ear. So the transportation is bid out four times a year, and most of the most of the bus drivers have routes that are 4 hours, mm-hmm. and 4 hours is benefited to us, and then they could be higher. They can go up to six or seven.
We have a few that are 8 hour. I think we still have a couple 8 hour drivers. We do have some 8 hour drivers. They work summer school. A lot of them, if their routes end early enough, they can do the field trips, and so that's often overtime. If it's on Saturday, it's extra time. So you know they're able to add more hours onto their guarantee. So when we look at what their rate is, we're looking at their bid guarantee. But most of them work hours above and beyond that to support other transportation field trips. Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks for the feedback and input on that. We were looking for strong opinions one way or the other, or just a discussion, and so thanks for the input.
Thank you. Do you want me to talk about something else for 15 more minutes?
No. I think you had one more slide, a closing slide. Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. I did. I'm sorry. Let me go back. So next steps. Yeah, the most riveting slide of all. Yeah. So ultimately, what do we do from here? So, you know, we're looking at the budget. We're seeing what that means for 18-19. We'll be watching the trailer bills to see how that translates. We're having conversations around staffing allocations and what the formulas look like in terms of teaching staff at the school sites. And then in May, the governor will release his revision. The chatter out there right now is that there's not going to be any big change to the May revised numbers. So we don't anticipate that there's going to be much of a difference between what was released for his proposal and what is released for the May revise. And then on June 7th, we'll bring the budget here. Well, obviously, there are many other conversations that take place around LCAP, like I talked about, et cetera. But on June 7th, we'll be bringing forward the proposed budget for the board to provide input there. And then on the 21st, we'll come back with the final for adoption.
Does it look like enrollment's going up or going down?
We're projecting right now enrollment to be going up by a little bit, about 100 and 150 kind of in the next kind of out 2 years, and then kind of staving off. But we'll see how that all pans out as, you know, the construction completes out there, but right now a small uptick.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, we just got that done last year. Okay. Any other questions?
And we'll know more during high school selection as well. If we're getting anybody coming back or yeah.
All right. Okay. Hey, thank you. That was great.
Thank you.
Thanks, Linda. Okay, so I will. Okay. Close the workshop. We have not quite 15 minutes till closed session.